Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests on tap today. First, we'll hear from Susanna Walters, author of The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality, an argument against queer embourgeoisement. And then at the bottom of the hour, Tony Samara of the Homes for All campaign of Right to the City talks about their new report on the affordability crisis facing renters in the USA. My first guest is Susanna Denuta Walters. She's the author of The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality, just out from NYU Press. With same-sex marriage now legal in 19 states, it's looking like the major goal of recent gay and lesbian activism is being achieved. This is good, there's no doubt about it. The turn in popular opinion from relentlessly hostile to more or less accepting, with the exception of not a small number of diehards, is unreservedly good. But is it enough? Or are we just expanding our definition of boring normality and giving up on a really transformative agenda? Susanna Walters, who's a professor of sociology at Northeastern University in Boston, argues the latter in her new book. Susanna Denuta Walters. Tolerance is a word that sounds nice on first hearing, but it's fraught with problems, starting with its etymology.
Yes, I mean, I think we tend to think that tolerance is a great thing. I mean, it's certainly better than, you know, being bashed on the street. But tolerance implies, I think, an ability to bear pain or hardship. I mean, when you think about the origins of the word and the usage of the word, we talk about tolerating, you know, a bad movie, a boring meeting, an irritating neighbor. We don't talk about tolerating great sex, tolerating a sunny day, tolerating something we love. So for me, the word tolerance not only has fraught origins in terms of the ability to bear pain and hardship, but also is a low bar for trying to imagine a celebration of queer difference and a real exploration of a broader kind of integration of gays and lesbians into American culture.
Well, okay, your book is an investigation of a real dilemma, though. One wants to be, you know, accepted.
Right.
On the other hand, one wants to mess things up some.
That's right.
And they're not necessarily in harmony.
Yeah, it's true. They're not. And look, you know, I'll take acceptance. I mean, from when I came out and from my history, it looks pretty good right now. And so there is a fair amount of sort of celebration in the book as well. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, acceptance and sort of fundamentally messing with things. But I do think that they are mutually exclusive if tolerance is the route to get it. In other words, you can say, you need to accept me for who I am. You accept me not out of the goodness of your heart because you're being tolerant and beneficent, but you accept me because, in fact, you see all that I can offer to transform in a positive way the way in which heterosexuals imagine love, intimacy, sexuality, etc. So there's a positive way, a deeper way to think of acceptance than mere tolerance.
You have a nice paraphrase of the old slogan, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. What was it, like, we're sort of gay?
We're here, yeah, we're kind of gayish, be nice to us.
Yeah. there does seem to be, that we're here, we're queer is from, the 90s. But,
right.
You know, you go back, you recall the early days in the late 60s, early 70s, when the early spokespeople and architects of gay liberation talked about a real transformation of the nature of sex and sexuality.
Yes.
What happened?
I think that's still going on. I do. I don't think it's disappeared. I think there are pockets of it all over the place. God knows it's going on in academia. It's going on in radical left politics and alliances all over the place. What I do think has happened, and it happens with most, you know, with so many social movements, in the move to assimilate, in the move to acceptance, in the move to get normalized, I think what has become seen as the mainstream gay and lesbian rights movement has gone down this path of tolerance and acceptance, linking those things to marriage, to the military, to a kind of normalization and access to a few civil rights as the sort of be-all and end-all of gay rights. But I don't think that radical impetus has gone. We need to reignite it. We need it to be, you know, more visible. But, you know, that kind of righteous, gay is good positivity, not just the radical gay moment, but even the Frank Kameny moment, you know, where it was sort of said, gay is good. This is not something to be tolerated or accepted. This is good. You know, we've moved from that moment, that, you know, that wonderful speech, you know, when he made the lawsuit, you know, this wonderful language of positivity. You know, we've gone to that is, look, we can't help ourselves. It's immutable. You know, we're born that way. That to me is a terrifying sort of trajectory. So we do need to reignite some of that more radical impulse. There's no question. But it is there. It's there in queer youth who are messing with gender every which way. You know, it's there in all kinds of gay and lesbian struggles. It's just not, it's been displaced by, from the, you know, by a sort of normalizing move by groups like HRC and some of the mainstream organizations, I think.
Well, something similar seems to have happened with feminism. You know, we went from a critique of the gender system to Sheryl Sandberg.
I know. I mean, we've gone from, you know, fight back to lean in, right? I mean, it is, but again, these things happen to so much, you know, and it's not an unfamiliar story. What is true is that, you know, the critique of gender, and the radical, you know, that kind of radical, thoroughgoing feminist impulse still exists. It's not that it's not there. It's not that people aren't writing about it, thinking about it, doing it, active in it. But what is true is that what wins the day in the public discourse is this sort of lean-in, lukewarm, kind of corporatist feminist. And I think we're seeing some similar things going on in the gay and lesbian movement as well.
Oh, that's hegemony for you.
Well, it is. Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. But those other things don't, I think it's important to say, they don't just disappear. They're not transcended. They're made less visible.
But what is different now is the growth of a large, which you might call, some people call Gay Inc., a gay establishment.
Yeah.
Which is funded by hedge fund guys and tech guys, and who only want to be normal.
That's right.
They want to be, you know, accepted in every way. The only thing is that they have a same-sex partner instead of an opposite-sex partner. You know, how did this the focus on marriage become so central?
You know, breaks my heart when I think that, you know, the two major issues for the gay rights movement in recent years have been military access and marriage. It just makes my feminist leftist bones shake. It is a strange and, you know, bizarre sort of move. Some of it is absolute, you know, the sort of roll of the dice with how politics have shaped, you know, have sort of fallen into place. We've been enormously successful in the marriage movement, and that's part of, I don't think anyone expected there to be such enormous victory. So I think it's taken over.
10 years.
Yeah.
It's totally transformed.
Totally transformed. I mean, I never believed this would happen. And
yeah,
in the last
that.
A couple of years, it's I mean, what's happened since the fall of DOMA? You know, just, you know, state after state after state. We've gone from 3 states to 17 states in, you know, no time at all. But I do think that gay marriage, one of the reasons gay marriage has been such a successful issue is that straight allies love it. It's the feel good, you know, gay charity of choice. I mean, you can pat yourself on the back, go to your lesbian wedding and feel like you've done your part for the gay rights movement. You don't have to think about sex. You don't have to think about challenging gender.
Because married people don't have sex anyway.
Yeah, and because it's all wrapped in the discourse of love and family, and, you know, marriage has such a kind of ideology around it about citizenship, right? How do you get, what's the easiest way to gain citizenship? Get married, you know, about nation, about maturity and love. So we wrap ourselves in that. So I think it's become a very good thing to ally with straight allies with. So that's part of the reason that marriage is, I think, taken over. It's an easy one. You know, it's same thing with the lean in stuff, you know, in that way. It's easy to speak up, you know, be more assertive in the workplace than to talk about, give me goddamn control over my reproductive rights. You know, let's really talk about the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, and I mean, people who argue that the focus on marriage is a nod to neoliberalism, because we're not talking about separating the rights to certain benefits from the marital status.
Absolutely.
As we would in a more social democratic discourse.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the marriage stuff is problematic on any number of levels. But even if you don't have that good feminist critique or critique of it as a neoliberal institution, even if you don't have that, one of the problems I have with what's going on with marriage is the association of any social movement with one single issue like that. And that, to me, is what's really become problematic. I mean, I have to tell you, there's not a time when I teach or I write or I speak about gay rights and it doesn't end up being a question about marriage. if you go on the internet and you Google gay rights, it's 90% of what you get is gay marriage. So it has become so seen as so synonymous, you know, when gay rights has become seen as absolutely synonymous with the acquisition of marital rights. And that to me is terrifying in terms of the future of a social movement. No social movement has that happened with. Not the women's movement, not the civil rights movement. I mean, there always was a, you know, a range, a panoply of rights that were addressed, whether it was abortion rights, pay equity, sexual violence, civil rights movement, you know, integration, access to education, et cetera, et cetera. So I am worried that we have as a community, not just about marriage per se settled on that, but that we have so conflated the range of issues around sexual freedom and liberation and gender freedom and liberation into this one single, not very liberatory institution.
Along with gay marriage, of course, is gay parenthood all the rage. One can hardly argue with people wanting to have children, but how does one negotiate that in a way that is not somehow recuperate the status quo?
Well, it is a tough one. I mean, you know, look, at some level, you know, all issues of parenting have some similarities. We all have to deal with obnoxious teenagers, with diapers earlier on, with college apps, all of the stuff of everyday parenting. But I do think that when we argue, when those of us who are gay parents argue that our families are no different, we all want the same things, and moreover, that our children will be no different, we do all of us a disservice. Right? My argument would want to be something quite different, which would be to say, actually, kids of gay parents might have, in fact, one would hope, broader, more diverse, more open, more fluid notions of gender and sexuality. One would hope they would. If they live in households in which the world is seen differently, in which household labor isn't divided by gender, in which parenting labor isn't divided by gender, one would hope they would become that next generation to, in fact, do some of this work of undermining gender norms and challenging gender norms. So I always cringe a bit when there are court cases and legal arguments that are about gay families, whether it's adoption cases or in the gay marriage case, of course, family and parenting came up a lot in all of the gay marriage cases. And our side, the gay rights side, says, you know, look, all the data shows that gay kids do just as well. Kids of gay parents do just as well as kids of straight parents. I want to say, really, that's the weak argument. Don't you want to say something different's going on here? That queer families are actually queer and that we're doing something, or at least there's the potential to do some things that undermine traditional family forms, challenge them, remake them. So I guess that to me, parenting is a great opportunity and queer forms of kinship is a great place to push back against the tolerance trap, push back against discourses of acceptance and have some of that more utopian vision. I mean, I hope my daughter thinks about gender and sexuality differently. I would feel I failed as a gay parent if she doesn't.
I'm speaking with Susanna Danuta-Walters, author of The Tolerance Trap, just out from NYU Press. So what gets overlooked or marginalized or effaced by this focus?
I think a lot gets marginalized. I mean, there's still basic civil rights things that get marginalized. So, for example, we have all this marriage mania, but we still can't pass ENDA. I mean, ENDA's been, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, has been introduced in Congress since the mid-90s. Still can't get passed. So it's still legal to fire people on the basis of their sexuality. Gay kids are still disproportionate among the homeless youth population. There's not a schoolyard where gay kids aren't still targets of abuse, bigotry, violence. We could go down the list of the sort of existing animus that still exists, both in structural terms, in legal terms, and institutional terms.
Yeah, the schoolyard is a rough place. I have an 8-year-old who's going through gendering right now.
It's a tough regime. It is still a tough regime. So I do think those questions, you know, and then in a deeper sense, you know, those questions of sexual freedom, of gender freedom and fluidity and liberation, of really challenging the gender order in all its permutations, that gets left aside.
Example of a trans kid in the classroom, right. And people will be very accepting and understanding, and the administration does not punish. But,
right.
we, but
everything else is still very gendered.
That's
the
right.
Toys are gendered. There are boys' things and girls' things.
That's
things.
Right.
So it's nothing else changes except that one thing that's
right. I mean, I think that's the language of tolerance. Is here's, you know, here's this different thing that we can't beat up anymore. We can't stone them anymore. That's not what a civilized society does. We can't ostracize them. You know, we have to tolerate and accept, but we're not going to allow that to transform us and the way we all do business. You know, so that you'll still walk down every, I mean, if you're a parent, you know that you walk down every Toys R Us, there's the boys' aisle, there's the girls' aisle.
I just asked for the men's room moments ago here.
Absolutely, you know. I mean, my daughter's older now, so I don't have to deal with that as much. She's 19. But, you know, there's not a moment where that gendering in such profound ways isn't taking place. So that tolerance and accept, you know, look, I'm glad to see kids of gay kids and kids of queer parents not being as victimized, isolated, ostracized as they were. But that's not the same as being robustly integrated in a way that transforms the very thing itself, the school, the university, the workplace, the law office, whatever it may be.
Jumping to another topic you read at some length in the book about, there is the question of choice versus determination. And a lot of people in the gay movement have embraced genetic determination. I was born this way. There's nothing I can do about it. Whenever you get into genetic determination, you're into seriously problematic territory.
Yes, I agree.
I interviewed Cordelia Fine about her book, whose title escapes me now, but it was all about the bogus science behind
right.
sex difference.
Yep.
And very, very similar things show up in this gay gene business.
Yep.
So what about the science and what's wrong with it?
Well, the science, as many people, I mean, you know, Rebecca Jordan Young, I mean, that the science of sex difference and gender difference has been shown to be thin science, to say the least. And the science of sexual orientation really is. What's so interesting about it, too, of course, is that no one's searching for the straight gene. You know, there's not a lot of science going on. Let's figure out this mystery called heterosexuality. Why do people do this crazy thing? I can't get it. Let's
figure out. Funny. Freud has a footnote in the three essays on sex in which he says opposite sex attraction also has to be explained.
Right.
And, you know, people think of him as an old dinosaur.
Right.
But in fact, he is
a mystery.
A little
right.
more up to date.
A little more up to date.
Than,
yeah, on
than
that
your
one.
Average scientist or
yeah,
journalist.
So when people are talking about, you know, biological determinants of sexuality, they're talking about homosexuality by and large. That's what the research is going on. You know, look, one thing that's important to say, I think, is that when we talk about choice versus determinism, part of it is that it's a false opposition. We're not talking about choice. When we talk about sexual choice, we're talking about choice like I chose to wear these shoes today, right? People feel their sexuality in deep and abiding ways. It is something very fundamental to who we are, how we understand ourselves. So it's not choice in a flippant way. But the idea that the opposite of that flippant sense is going to be some, you know, there's some endocrine system that makes, you know, a singular kind of system that goes to works, or there's a genetic argument that there's a biological immutability and a determination to sexuality flies in the face of most people's experience of how sexuality changes over the life course. But also, as you say, I mean, the part of that that gets me so terrified is that people would use this as a basis for civil rights. Even if you believe you experience your sexuality as innate in some way, who the hell cares? That is no ground for civil rights. You know, the idea that we would say, you have to give us our rights because we have a compulsion. We can't help ourselves. Therefore, we should get our rights has never worked very well for most people. And as you just noted, I mean, biologically determinist arguments are by and large, historically, have been used in the service of genocide, of discrimination, of bigotry. History of Jews, history of African Americans, history of women. You know, so it is to me, one of the worst moments, one of the worst aspects of our current moment is the way in which the born this way ideology has come to be the hegemonic and dominant ideology. All good thinking liberals are supposed to believe this. This is not the position of the right wing. This is the position of good thinking liberals.
You quote my Twitter antagonist, Brian Fisher. I think that guy is really a piece of work.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't like this. You know, he wants, I guess, to believe that people make bad choices for which that God should punish them.
Right. Well, we're in a real dilemma here, right? Because, you know, if you listen to or read any of the transcripts, for example, of the hearings around Prop 8, One of the things that was really interesting in a scary way, was that our side, the folks arguing for gay marriage rights, sounded like these incredible biological determinists. You know, gay people should be able to marry because it is an innate part of who they are. It's biologically determined, et cetera, et cetera. And the anti-gay marriage people sounded like postmodern feminists, right? So they are going on saying, well, sexuality, it's fluid. You know, we don't really know why people are the way they are. Things change over the life course. You can't really pin down desire in a singular way.
Which on the face of it is hard to disagree with.
It's absolutely. So, but we do need to fight back against the biologically determinist argument. The question, it's not whether it's right or wrong. I don't think we know that. The science isn't there either way. But it's the wrong question to ask when you're talking about civil rights. And it's a dangerous question to ask. And the way in which this is seeped, the Born This Way stuff, look, Lady Gaga, the way this is seeped into popular culture, into film, television, legal argumentations, pundits. I mean, there's not a pundit arguing for gay rights that doesn't talk about Born This Way. And, it is the liberal ideology of choice. So the right wing talks about choice and volition, in a terrible way, right? It's a bad choice. God's going to punish you. You can change or, blah, blah, blah. We talk about no choice and biological destiny and immutability. It's a topsy-turvy world. It makes no sense.
Yeah, fluidity doesn't have a large lobby.
True enough.
Which is a nice way to head towards a coda. What beyond tolerance? Spin out a more utopic view for us than a world of tolerance and determination.
Well, I do think, this is where, maybe I'll get a little nostalgic for some of the old days. I mean, I do think the world beyond tolerance is a world we always keep imagining. It's a world where no one asks, it's not about anybody tolerating anybody or accepting anyone, where those aren't even the questions we ask. It is a world where some of that radical impulse of really challenging gender norms and gender binarisms, of having gender be determinants of desire, of position in the world, of who you can love and how you can love, of what jobs you can hold, becomes something that is just gone, that is just gone. And so I think the sort of older alliances that are still vibrant between the women's movement, civil rights movement, and gay and lesbian struggles needs to be reinvigorated. So I think, the world beyond tolerance is a world where, the issues aren't one of acceptance. The issues are ones of transformation, where queer difference is allowed to affect everyone in ways that we can't know in advance how exciting they will be.
But, of course, that makes some people anxious.
Oh, yeah. it makes you much easier to say, look, let us have our rights because we're no different than you. We won't change. I mean, there's all this stuff when they talk about gay marriage, when they make the arguments for gay marriage, they say, listen, it won't challenge your marriage at all. My gay marriage will have no effect on your marriage. To which I would respond, if it doesn't, it's not very gay at all. I mean, if it doesn't affect the way you think, straight people think about their intimacies, their ways of dividing up labor around gender norms and so on, then what good is it? It should challenge it. At its best, gay marriage should undermine the way in which heterosexuals understand their relationships.
This one shouldn't be afraid of a slippery slope argument.
That's right. That's right.
That was Susanna DeNudo-Walters, a professor of sociology at Northeastern. She's the author of The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality, just out from NYU Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
The British police are the best in the world. I don't believe one of these stories I've heard about them raising up pubs for no reason at all. Lining the customers up by the wall. Picking out people, knocking them down. Resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground. Searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
and a song of Glad to Be Gay by the Tom Robinson Band, which Susanna Walters mentions in her book as being part of the soundtrack to her closeted teenagerhood. Originally written by Robinson for the London Gay Pride Parade in 1976, it was released on a record in 1978. It was a digitized version of my copy of the vinyl album, which is why you might have heard some old-fashioned clicks and pops there. Next up is Tony Samara. Samara is the lead author of a new report by the Homes for All campaign of Right to the City, The Rise of the Renter Nation, on the affordability crisis facing the nation's renters. Coverage of the great housing bubble and bust is focused on homeowners. Overlooked in this coverage is the fate of the 35% of Americans who rent their housing. During the interview, we talk about the entry of private equity groups like Blackstone into the housing market. These giant pools of Wall Street money are buying up rental properties, hoping to package the rental income streams into securities and eventually profit from a housing recovery by selling the dwellings into a stronger market. This marks the entry of big global finance into what used to be a local business. During the interview, Tony Samara mentions a study by Occupier Homes Atlanta of Blackstone's activities in that city. It's too early to draw any conclusions yet, but tenants interviewed for the report said it's difficult to get repairs done or to contact the landlord about any other matter. Most people rightly complain about their landlords, but bringing in private equity sharks is likely to take these problems to a new level. Blackstone's tenants in Atlanta are facing stiff late fees and rent increases and an itchy finger on the eviction trigger. We're still early in this game, so we don't know what the long-term consequences are, but given the way private equity firms treat the companies that they take over, the portents are not good. Typically, their MO is to buy a company, cut costs, load it up with debts to finance the payment of fees and dividends to the private equity firm, and then sell the thing, debt hobbled, a few years later at a big profit, after having looted what they could during their period of ownership. The PE formula doesn't always work, but when it does, it makes the owners and investors quite rich. If the PE model can be translated into housing, we could expect shoddy maintenance, crummy service, harassment, rent gouging, and a great deal of volatility and uncertainty for tenants. At least that's what we might expect. We'll see if they live up to expectations. Okay, now back to Tony Samara and the rise of the renter nation. You can find the full report at homesforall.org. You can find the Occupy Our Homes Atlanta report on Blackstone at occupyourhomesatl.org. I apologize for the hum in the phone signal. Tony Samara. We are suffering a rental affordability crisis. You've done a report on it. Just lay out some of the dimensions of the problem.
Sure, and thanks for having me. So the report essentially makes three connected arguments in presenting an analysis of the growing renters crisis. The first is that we've talked a lot about in this country the housing crisis, but one of our major concerns is that in that conversation and in the policy solutions that come out of it, renters are almost completely ignored. And so we are making the argument that the housing crisis is predominantly a renters crisis, a crisis centered in renter populations. The second big point that we're making is that the renter crisis is disproportionately a crisis for lower-income people, people of color, young people, people concentrated in urban regions. And then third, that that current approaches to thinking about housing stability, housing security, are inadequate. On the one hand, most of the ways that we think about solutions focus specifically just on affordability, and of course we agree that affordability is important and vital, but we have a lot of critiques of the ways in which affordability is measured, and so in many ways it under or it misrepresents the scope of the problem. But the second big point is that the report also offers a broader range of approaches to thinking about real housing security that doesn't just focus on affordability and reforming affordability, but it also looks at accessibility, health and sustainability, the quality of housing, the long-term stability of housing and protection from displacement, and also community control as opposed to control by certainly by market forces that have been so destructive in many communities. So the concept of housing security that we introduce is about reforming affordability measures, but also introducing these other what we call pillars. So there are five pillars overall.
All right, let's approach each of these in turn. I'm in New York, and a lot of people here rent, but I know that's not typical of the United States. So give us some dimension, idea of who rents in elsewhere outside New York City.
It's a very good question. And actually, in the executive summary, in one of the first couple of pages, there's a map of the U.S. with major urban areas, I think about 25, and the percentage of renters. And actually, in most major urban areas, the majority or near majority of households are renter households. And that's part of the underpinning of the argument that the renter's crisis is often, in many ways, concentrated in urban and metro regions where renters are more likely to be living. The homeownership rate is an interesting statistic. So it's about 65% of households in the United States are homeowners. With the exception of the housing bubble, when it went up to 70, that 65% has been about the average for about four decades. So if you look from the late 60s up until the present, with the exception of that bubble, the rate has hovered between 63 and 65%. With all the massive federal support for homeownership, it's never really moved above that level. So we had about a 35% rent population for this whole period, again, primarily located among moderate and lower income households. So part of the argument that we're making is that when you're looking at housing stability for these populations, which are concentrated in urban areas, which are disproportionately people of color, for example, Black and Latino households have never been more than 50% of homeowners, so they've always been disproportionately or majority renter households, that if you're going to deal with the housing crisis, this is where you need to be concentrating your efforts, not on homeowners only or exclusively, and also not on moving more and more people into the homeownership class. I mean, for some people, that will be a reality.
Before you go on, we do make a national obsession of homeownership in policy and ideology, and you can't avoid it. Do you think that's a good thing? Is homeownership a virtue in itself?
I don't think you can talk about homeownership in the abstract. I mean, if you talk about it here concretely in terms of the private market, and that's part of what I was saying about the four-decade trend, is that the federal government and local governments put huge amounts of resources into promoting homeownership. And yet, with the exception of the speculative bubble, that ownership rate has pretty much stayed the same for 40 years. So that says a lot about the kind of smartness of that kind of investment, hundreds of billions of dollars a year without really nudging the needle at all, except when you go into a speculative market, which then, of course, crashed, and most of the people who gained those homes now are back to being renters. So I don't think it's a good investment in that model of private home ownership through the market. There's just not a lot of evidence that we're going to get much beyond the 65%. So we have to think about that other 35%, which looks like it might even be a growing proportion going forward as the economy settles into this kind of entrenched inequality, that we need to think outside of the home ownership box as the way to achieve housing stability for moderate and lower income households.
And that third of the population, roughly, that does not own but rents, this is mostly a low-income group, and that's what's really limiting, that puts an upper limit on the homeownership rate?
Right. I think that's a big part of it, is that when you're talking about renters, they're disproportionately moderate and lower income. And even under the best circumstances, those are populations that struggled to move into the homeownership ranks. But again, looking forward now, the next generation, given the kind of entrenched inequality we're dealing with, even that seems like a kind of golden age. And even under those ideal, not ideal, but under those circumstances that were certainly more dynamic in terms of growth than now, the needle budged very little except outside of predatory lending and speculative markets around home ownership.
And of course, we had a major housing crash. And what did that do to the rental situation? I mean, the people are focused all on mortgage holders and homeowners and people who can't afford the houses they bought. But what did it do to the population of semi-permanent renters?
Well, the major effect was that it flooded the market with renters. So part of the reason we've seen rents rising and available rental units for moderate and lower income renters disappears because a lot of the people who lost homes in the crash have now become renters. They tend to be at the higher end of the rental market income scale, and so they are pricing out often a lot of the lower income renters. So I think the numbers from the Joint Center on Housing Studies at Harvard were that between 2000 and 2010, we saw 5 million new renter households, and they're projecting another 4.5 million over the next decade. So the number of renters is just growing rapidly, I think over the last couple of years at the rate of about almost 1 million a year. Clearly demand, supply is not keeping up with that. And so we've seen a huge crunch in terms of available rental stock, and that's hitting lower income renters the hardest in terms of their ability to find housing that they can afford at any kind of of reasonable measure that doesn't force them to divert spending from food and health care and transportation and other things into paying for rent.
It's always struck me as bizarre that rising prices are taken as a sign of a healthy housing market. I mean, the rising prices mean that one of life's essentials is getting more out of reach for more and more people. But you might have thought that the housing bust by reducing house prices might have eased the affordability burden, but that has not happened.
Not for renters, no, not at all. Not at all.
And now we've got some private equity types moving in, right, and buying up housing?
Right, so that's another big concern among many of the Rights of the City organizations is the entrance of private equity into the rental market, essentially moves towards securitizing rent payments. And so similar to what we saw with the private home ownership market, the capital is coming in looking to aggregate rental properties into these big kind of portfolios where those rents then become a new form of security. And so the concern, of course, is on the one hand, what kind of quality and management will we get in these properties that are owned in the tens of thousands, often by these big equity players? You know, what kind of landlords will they make? And we're starting to see some evidence come out around that. There's a report in Atlanta by Occupier Homes Atlanta to begin to look at some of this, I think, in LA as well. The second bigger question is, will it create now a another bubble, this time a rental market bubble as opposed to a housing market bubble, for many of the very, very same underlying reasons around, you know, these being primarily profit maximization-driven initiatives, not housing security-driven initiatives.
And, of course, traditional landlords have never been ones to endear themselves to renters, but I'm guessing the private equity guys are even nastier?
Well, that may be true. Again, I said, you know, the Occupier Homes in Atlanta has done a report. I think there's some reports coming out of L.A. to begin to look at what happens to the actual, what's day-to-day life like in these investment portfolios. So it may be the case that they're worse overall. I think at some level that remains to be seen because this is so new. But what is very clear is that it removes greatly the accountability. I mean, it's one thing to try to hold a landlord accountable who maybe owns, you know, 20 properties in your city or in your neighborhood. You know, maybe their office is someplace else in the city, someplace else in the state. But now you're talking about globally mobile financial capital. How do you hold a Blackstone accountable when there's mold in your unit? Right. I think it decreases the potential accountability, decreases the amount of control that tenants have over their living conditions, because you're dealing with now landlords, to the extent that you can even call them landlords, who are, you know, where are they? How do you deal with them?
Blackstone's everywhere. They just bought our mortgage, too, and they're assembling rental properties as well.
Well, housing, you know, the essentials are always a good investment.
I'm speaking with Tony Samara of the Homes for All campaign and the Right to the City Alliance about their new report on the rental crisis in the United States. I was struck by one of the graphs in your report that you had about 20 or 25 cities in a bar graph of affordability problems. And it used to be that in those sorts of graphs, New York City stood out as a real outlier for expense and housing burden. But the New York bar was not much higher than anybody else's. This is now really a countrywide problem.
It is. And that, you know, again, that's part of what we're trying to get out there, is this idea that you can't think about renters as a secondary problem or as kind of peripheral to the real housing crisis or the real housing solutions, that renters are an incredibly, I mean, they're a large part of the housing population. They look to be a growing proportion of the housing population, and it's where more lower-income people are concentrated. Now we're beginning to recognize also that this is, as you pointed out, not just concentrated in a few of the more well-known housing market regions like the Bay Area and New York, but it's everywhere. This is becoming, or has become already, a national systemic structural problem that needs national systemic structural solutions.
And on the supply side, you said earlier there's not enough supply to match the demand for rentals because of all these new renters on the market. Do you see any signs that builders are responding, or is the supply really constrained for a long time?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I'm still wrapping my head around it. I mean, I think on the one hand, yes, we do need to build more housing, build more density, especially in these highly impacted regions. And it can't be market rate, obviously, which is, of course, the big push when there is a push for building homes is to build them at market rate because the return, of course, is greater. But market rate is out of reach price-wise for the vast majority of renter population. So you're not going to build your way out of this crisis. So, yes, there is a need to build. There is a need to build greater density in many cases, but building is not going to be the way we get out of this, even under the best case scenario, right? And of course, we're struggling against the push to build more market rate, with the idea that eventually this will mean that lower income renters will benefit. This kind of trickle down housing policy, trickle down didn't work, you know, in the broader economy. I don't think it's going to work in housing. So part of what that means is that we're seeing more and more push for rent stabilization measures to be brought back, whether that's rent control or versions of rent control or other kinds of measures that say, look, whether or not we can build enough housing over the next generation, let's say, we need to deal with the problem today. And to deal with the problem today means dealing with the housing that exists in part as well. And that means dealing with the fact that for more and more households, today's rent, this month's rent, is too expensive. And so we need measures that will deal with that immediately. And so we're seeing a growing, I think, growing support at local and municipal levels for rent stabilization measures. We're seeing it here in the Bay Area. We're seeing it in California, and we're seeing it in other places as well. And I think that is an important development that we're dealing with supply, not only in terms of building new housing that's affordable and genuinely affordable, not just affordable for higher income renter households, but for all renter households, but also then introducing or reintroducing or strengthening and closing the loopholes in existing rent stabilization measures.
And I've heard some housing advocates, and this is a policy that seems to be being embraced by our new mayor in New York, Bill de Blasio, of letting developers build all the luxury condos they want, and then requiring at least some affordable units be part of the mix, either on site or nearby. What do you think of this strategy? Is it a good idea?
I mean, every affordable unit is a good thing, but it's not going to make a dent in the affordable housing problem in a place like New York. You're talking about small fractions of the overall housing. I think what we're talking about is inclusionary zoning, meaning that yes, you can build market rate, but we're going to ask you to build, and it might be determined by law. I think in California it's 15%. Other places might have no specific number, or it might be slightly higher, but up to 20%. Given the demand, making 15% of new developments affordable barely makes a dent in the demand for affordable housing. The second issue is, and I think it's an important one, it's kind of a policy wonkish issue, but it's an important one, is that what do we mean by affordability? If affordability means, you know, 80, 90, 100% of area median income, you're not touching, in a place like New York, lower-income populations. So we need to think about, again, this is one of the main planks of the report, is rethinking what we mean by affordability and the way that that gets operationalized in policy to really redirect affordability measures towards low and very low-income households.
Okay, so let's turn to what should be done. We already, just through the tax code, the homeowner interest deduction is an enormous subsidy to homeownership. So we're already spending a lot of government money on subsidizing, you know, homeownership. What is a better approach? What sort of things are you thinking of to make housing seriously affordable?
So one is beginning to shift some of those resources, right? So the I think the amount of money invested towards homeownership versus rentals is 4-1. Right, so homeownership gets four times the amount of federal resources that renters do, even though renters are much more likely to be burdened by housing costs. So there needs to be a shift in those spending priorities. And that shift, of course, reflects something you alluded to earlier, which is that there's this kind of ideological commitment in this country to private homeownership as the only or most desirable form of ownership, and the money reflects that ideology. And that needs to change. We need to begin shifting those resources towards supporting lower income, very low and low income renters. So just the spending priorities at the federal level need to change. So that's one big one. At the local level, whether that's at the city level or at the regional level, beginning to move more protections for renters through the legislative process. That could be rent stabilization, it could be just cause eviction clauses, things that give low and very low income households a sense of security, so they cannot worry about whether in the next month or the next year they're going to lose their home, either because the rent shoots up or because the landlord evicts them so they can flip it to a condo, whatever else it might be. But, you know, each locality will have a different set of needs around what rent stabilization and housing security looks like, but beginning to move those through the local level, and of course changes at the state level as well in policy, is vital. We do need to build more housing, and I think there needs to be a concerted federal response. Partly that's shifting the resources, but rolling out massive housing construction for moderate and lower income households, that is not going to be something that the market will do on its own, even with incentives. It needs to be something that is a much more, again, concerted nationwide effort to provide more housing. Some of the other concrete things that we ask for or that we talk about in the report are fully funding the National Housing Trust, which is in part established to make sure that there is an expansion of affordable housing at the lower and moderate income levels. So Right to the City and some of its allies are involved in campaigns to push through that reform at the federal level. So those are some of the things. Again, the report gives a kind of fairly detailed breakdown of specifics, but at the broader level, these are some of the kind of big changes that I think need to happen.
And what about traditional public housing, which is seriously out of fashion? But is there a place for that?
There is. I mean, I certainly think so. I think many of the organizations involved in the campaign think so. I mean, the problem with public housing is not a problem with public housing. It's a problem with the neglect of public housing. So the funding, for example, for the maintenance of public housing has been cut for decades. And so when people talk about the kind of dilapidated conditions of public housing as an example of the failure of public housing as a policy, what they're really talking about is the failure of the government, of the federal government, to support basic maintenance of those units, and instead of maintaining them, they've in fact been tearing them down at a breakneck pace over the last 20 years, primarily through the HOPE 6 program, and replacing them with these mixed income units, which of course leads to a net loss of affordable units for low and very low income households. So when I talk about the building of housing orchestrated at the federal level, that could look like public housing, or it could look like something similar, but I certainly think that there's a role for a new era of public housing, however we want to kind of define that relative to what it meant in the past. And in fact, public housing grew out of, you know, the era of the Great Depression and the New Deal, because it was very widely recognized that a stable and prosperous society needs people to have stable homes. And that was in the Housing Act of 1949. Congress committed itself to that principle and to providing and supporting decent housing for all, and the next 50 years is essentially an abdication of that commitment.
Do we need the federal government to do this, or can states and localities do things on their own?
Yes, there's a role for every level of government, and equally, if not more importantly, there's a role for social movement mobilization, right? I mean, the federal government, even under the best circumstances, is going to do very little for low and very low-income communities on its own. So this is a question of mobilization and advocacy. But in terms of what the government can do, yes, there is a role for the federal government, there are roles for state governments, and there are certainly roles for local governments, certainly around protections for renters. And the more that they can coordinate, the better. But again, that's only going to happen if there's substantial pressure applied from below, because, you know, they have from Blackstone Equity down to real estate agencies and associations pushing in the opposite direction much of the time. So that's kind of one of the ways that the fight breaks down politically.
It seems like the affordability crisis, you know, takes on several different characters. I mean, we've got on one hand a city like Detroit, where housing is theoretically cheap, but there are an awful lot of extremely burdened households in Detroit. And at the other hand, you've got places like San Francisco or New York, where incomes are at least high on paper, but housing prices are even higher. So, I mean, how do you deal with these separate problems?
Well, so when we talk about the hot markets like New York or the Bay Area, I mean, the median incomes may be high, but what that median kind of obscures is the fact that incomes concentrate towards the higher and lower ends and hollow out in the middle. So the median can be kind of deceptive in that sense. And so that's one of the reasons why, again, going back to something you said earlier, that strong growth and increasing housing prices isn't necessarily, and in fact is often not, good for moderate and low income groups, because in fact they hide the level at which this increases housing costs burdens on these lower income populations. But again, that's hidden by the median or by the average, if that's the case. And so policies need to then begin to address the fact that you're talking about this kind of deep, sustained structural inequality that moves incomes towards either end of the income scale.
That was Tony Samara, lead author of The Rise of the Renter Nation, a report just out from the Homes for All campaign of Right to the City. Apologies again for that hum in the phone signal. Don't know where that came from. You can find the report at homesforall.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another souvenir of 1978, Eno, Möbius, and Rodelius during Luftschloss from the album After the Heat. Till next week, bye.